Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey guys, this is the final interview of the year that conveniently is going to be able to wrap up and tie together all the conversations I had about the defense and national security, combined with technology, of course, space, over this past month. Speaking with Heather Jo Richmond, she is the founder and co-chair of the AUKUS Defense Investor Network. Before that, she was the founder of the Defense Investor Network out in Palo Alto. Obviously, in all these episodes I did, everything from the conversation with Jill Lonsdale to last week's with Mike Slaw involved all these different buzzwords, all these broader concepts, everything from the VC to the national security and technology spaces. So I thought this was a great opportunity to kind of take a step back and not only talk about Heather's new work at the AUKUS Defense Investor Network, but also kind of tie together the broad themes, because as she kind of discusses in this episode, there is a huge moment for everyone when it comes to dialing down and focusing on these mission-focused topics. So I very much enjoyed this conversation. Hope everyone has a great rest of the holidays. We're going to post a live event I did earlier in the month on Friday, but this will wrap the interviews once again. So huge thank you for the Foundation for American Innovation, and of course to all of you for giving the realignment a great, great year. Looking forward to the next one going into the 2024 election. Heather Richmond, welcome to the realignment.
Marshall, thank you so much for having me.
I was just saying this before we got into the recording, but listeners will know I've been doing these really, really deep dives on all aspects of defense and technology, also with the intersection of national security, obviously. And I think all those individual episodes are really great, but to make this a coherent series where we could fit all these different themes together, whether you're talking to someone at Palantir or Scale AI or someone at a think tank, I think you're the perfect guest to tie your actual interests and focuses into all of that. But that said, we're also here to discuss news in your world and projects you're working on. So we'll kind of start there. So since 2019, you've kind of like informally led this effort called the Defense Investors Network. And a few months ago and this month, there's just been this announcement that like that work with defense investors has spread out into the AUKUS space. So can you just introduce all of that with, of course, a quick introduction of what AUKUS is in the first place?
Absolutely. And again, thank you for having me. I think, you know, our history is at a major tipping point right now, as far as what the face of war looks like and kind of how all encompassing, you know, it is and how much we need to be looking across sectors to be involved in all of this. And I think the more that we can make our electorate aware, our venture community aware, our entrepreneurs aware, you know, it's only going to benefit, I think, our countries, our allies, you know, that sort of thing. So when I wake up every day, this is what I think about, for better or for worse. And I live right here in Silicon Valley. I live on Sand Hill Road. It's very cliche, actually. But, you know, I'm surrounded by it. And I'm surrounded, and I've been out here for about 20 years now after I'd spent about 5 years in Washington, D.C. doing appropriations, budget, and tax work. But living out here, it's inspiring how quickly things can move here. And I think if we're, you know, as we're looking as a country around national security and around kind of this next iteration of technological advantage, frankly, you know, a lot of the catchphrases out here, autonomy, AI, you know, cyber, those sorts of things are moving very quickly here. And the more that we can engage with our national security apparatus, the more that we can have open communication, and that's really the kicker here I'll get into, is really important. And I think that a lot of times, having come from government and also venture, these two worlds haven't had a common language and haven't felt comfortable talking to one another, and in some cases aren't allowed to talk to one another, which I think is unfortunate and needs to change. And so I'll start with AUKUS a little bit, and then I'll kind of kick back to how the DIN, lovely three-letter acronym that starts with the D. But AUKUS, you know, AUKUS is this amazing trilateral agreement that the US, the UK, and Australia have put together. Just very quickly, there's two pillars to it. People talk about pillar one and pillar two. I'm very, very much focused on pillar two. Pillar one is really around this conversation around nuclear submarines. Hugely important for these three countries and to come together and to figure out, you know, how best we can, frankly, arm Australia. Their location around our, you know, in our globe is very important, and considering some of our adversaries right now. And probably for years to come. And so this first piece of it was really around, you know, these three countries coming together and figuring out how best do we work together to make sure that the best capability, the best technology is in the hands of both the US and our allies. Pillar two is everything else. And so pillar two, and I should know these by heart. I don't, I have my cheat sheet here, but cyber, AI, quantum, undersea capabilities, hypersonics, we'll get into that, counter hypersonics, EW, and information sharing. So there are some of those things I think that most people are familiar with, obviously cyber, AI, the concept of quantum, you know, communication technologies. I think once you get into hypersonics and undersea capabilities, it might be a little more niche. As far as being, you know, kind of more national security focused. Hypersonics are weapons, weapon systems. Counter hypersonics are obviously a more, you know, the defense against those. And so we could have a whole other podcast around that and how I feel about that. But I will say this, I think it's been really interesting to see investors start to ask a lot of these questions. What are these things? You know, we call it, you know, there are some investors that are very comfortable with weapons, with weaponization of things. There are some investors that aren't. And so just kind of like anything else in the world, you're going to get lots of different colors, lots of different opinions, lots of different thoughts on these things. And I think, you know, what I've tried to create is a place where we can have all of these conversations and find out, you know, who in the investment community is comfortable doing what. And then how we can build a mechanism to enable new folks coming into the investment community that's encompassing national security. So I'll kick it back a little bit. I've been out here in the Valley, like I said, for 20 years. I've been working with a group called BM&T since about 2015. Very briefly, right before that, I was part of the founding team of something called Elemental Accelerator, which is actually a Navy initiative using Hawaii as a testbed for energy innovation. And I bring that up because it's been amazing to see only second time since IncuTel, taxpayer dollars brought outside to create a not-for-profit, basically investment arm, and do it in such a way that is legal, that is very ethical, but also very effective. And so we've leveraged that first $30 million back in 2012, leveraged about $2 billion in private capital, have about 150 portfolio companies to date, and actually have partnered with Emerson Collective, which is the Steve and Lorraine Jobs investment platform. So right there, that's again, a whole other podcast, but really an example of bringing all these different pieces and players together. Around something at the time of 2012 was around energy and is around energy, but that was a very difficult time for energy innovation with a lot of folks, I think, in the more traditional venture community realizing how difficult it is and how long it takes. Fast forward.
So let's again, pause there. So Heather, I listened to one of your previous podcast appearances and you are a difficult interview because you're incredibly fluent, but you also like drop all this information in. And I kind of want to like interrupt. So I'm just going to be, don't take this as me being rude. I just want to interrupt because so many things I want to talk about. Glad you brought up InQtel. We actually had Gilman Louie on the podcast last month. So folks will remember that's, you know, the effort launched in 1999 that was, CIA's venture capital arm. Speaking of the elemental energy aspect there too, though, I think you're kind of getting to the theme of this episode, which is in these critical sectors with critical industries, InQtel and the thing you described in Hawaii, those are both not driven by traditional venture capital notions. I said this with one of my RNDF episodes, but the problem with VC when you apply it to defense is that with VC, if 99 out of 100 things fail, but that one thing is just going to like return the fund five times over, who cares about those other 99 that didn't work? The problem is, though, in this category of defense, 99 failures for one success actually doesn't work. So can you just kind of talk about like the space and how we kind of could innovate models there?
Absolutely. I think my favorite non-favorite is, you know, around here in the Valley, it's, you know, it's fail fast. People will say, you know, get in there and try things and see what works and then iterate. And you're not failing fast. You're just, you know, you're trying to speed up the fact that the pace at which you figure out what is going to work and what's not going to work. So the problem is if you say fail inside the US military, a lot of times that includes loss of life. You don't know. The consequences are very different. Also, we built a mechanism that is programmed not to fail. That's just not a concept. And we can't fail 99 times out of 100 because the end goal is not to just make the money back, right? The goal is to strengthen our country and to protect our citizens and to protect our allies. And so it's a very different goal. And so, and I think that's one reason these two worlds have had a very difficult time aligning over time. I will say this, I think the world of InQtel, I think what InQtel has set up and proven is that, you know, you can have an inside entity as sensitive as the CIA, you know, coming out here and really signaling. I mean, that's really what I believe, you know, InQtel's greatest advantage has been. They create work programs where they're actually doing demonstration projects. Fast forward, Elemental Accelerator, has a work program that does demonstration projects. And so what it does is, having been a former appropriator, it's not just here's some money, please go as fast as you can and give me my money back times 10. It's here is an actual project that we're going to work with you on with folks from inside the government in the intelligence committee or the Department of Defense. And then there's going to be milestones, and there's going to be, it is something that we can then go back to Congress, who funds us, and go back to the American taxpayer and show that real work has been done and successful work has been done. And again, not everything's going to be a success, you know, especially day one. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of iterating there, but it's not this 99 of 100 is not going to work. I mean, that just doesn't make anyone comfortable. That being said, though, you know, I think once you've got some of the technological expertise, the world-class talent, the entrepreneurs that are out here, that more and more are becoming national security minded just because of some of the industries that they're engaged in. There's a mind shift about that, and about, you know, figuring out, you know, we are taking some later stage companies. And so, you know, I guess a lot of time, for a long time inside of government, we've got DARPA, we've got amazing R&E work being done, research and engineering work being done. I think, though, there's been, we call it the Valley of Death, but there's, like, you know, the Silicon Valley Valley of Death, and then there's the government Valley of Death. They're very different, and they're both massive. But the government Valley of Death is, you know, working, identifying early stage companies, but then getting them to a stage, we call it a TRL, a technology readiness level, but then we also have an IRL, an investment readiness level, and then we have just a, I'm making this up on the spot, a deployment readiness level. Like, when is a company big enough, strong enough, robust enough to then actually engage effectively with our military? Because it's a big thing.
Yeah, could you explain the Valley of Death in, like, the typical Silicon Valley context then?
Sure. So, I mean, Valley of Death typically is, you know, when you first get, you know, venture funding to your first revenue, right? That's it. You've got your money, and then you're running like hell to have some revenue. That's kind of that first Valley of Death. In the military, like I said, in the government, it really is, you know, how do we identify a company? We've got these different contracting authorities called SBIRs, a Small Business Innovation Research, SBIR, a SBIR grant. It is a grant, so there's not equity taken, which is lovely. We call it non-dilutive funding, which out here is like magic. But the idea that, but getting, you know, a SBIR, which is an early stage contract, usually there's a SBIR phase one and a SBIR phase two. A SBIR phase one is usually under anywhere between $50,000 and $200,000. A SBIR phase two might be anywhere between $1.5 and $2 million. So again, small amounts of money, but again, to do some sort of pilot project. So really engaging that IncuTel model, the EEX model, you know, small steps, but getting a phase two in there, but then going from a phase two to an actual, we call it sort of phase three or a program of record, that's a huge jump. If you're going from a $1.5 million pilot project to a $50 million, $100 million more, you know, size contract within the US military, that's a whole different level. And it sometimes takes 3 to 5 years. So even just the timing can create a massive Valley of Death. And that's actually where it's usually less about the money and more about that timing. When you've got a startup and your next major contract or your first major contract for the military is coming in 3 to 5 years, that's a tough road. And so investors here, you know, have been working to figure out how do we bridge that. I will take a breath after I say this. I think one of the things that we've been talking about a lot, and so we've got, you know, kind of traditional large tier one, tier two venture capitalists, you know, that, you know, that you've got the Andreessen Horowitzes have done amazing work, and we can get to that as well. You know, we've got NEA that's put, you know, Crosslink Capital, Accel, a bunch of these funds. I mean, Founders Fund, I could go on, that have done Venrock, that have done a lot of this investing at a very high level. We have this other group that's kind of popped up in the last, I'd say, 4 years, which is very dual use funds. They're smaller now, but they're growing quite rapidly. And their whole portfolio is definitely, you know, developing around capabilities that have both commercial use cases, as well as military use cases. So
that's the dual use terminology.
The dual use terminology is a commercial application as well as a military application. The interesting part is, traditionally, I think when the concept was built, it was, you know, go to commercial first, you know, let commercial break it and fix it and figure it out, and then engage with the military. There are some capabilities and some that are really involved in AUKUS that are going to be dual use eventually, but that might be military first. And that's been, I mean, GPS, right? GPS was military first, and then now it's very commercial. So I think dual use can be both ways. And I guess it really kind of depends on the capability. It depends on the company. Frankly, it depends on the most urgent needs of our military as well. You know, is this something that we need right now, or is this something that we can help the commercial sector can help mature and then bring to it when it's a more mature capability? Starting with kind of the, you know, the I won't say top two, more traditional venture capitalists, institutional capitalists, and then you've got kind of the dual use. What we found, and actually kind of what I learned from working in energy, is this concept around patient capital. So, you know, we have venture is not patient. Venture is aggressive, and that's
by its very nature.
By its very nature, and in certain ways we need that. Our government, in certain ways, needs a big prod and be like, we need to move faster. The running joke that's not a joke is, you know, we have the technology available. It's an adoption problem. It's a procurement problem. So we can get back to that as well. But what we've been finding when we were doing work, you know, when I've been doing work in the energy space, is energy is also extremely regulated, takes a very long time. It's a system. You know, you have to have relationships and trusted relationships. We'll also get back into that. With utilities, with you know, integrators, with storage, with generation, all these different pieces. And our Valley, God bless us, you know, tried a while back to kind of get into energy investing. And it was a pretty quick retreat because it does take a long time. It does not meet traditional venture guidelines and timelines. And so what we found, though, is there are a number of folks out there that have kind of come out of the woodwork that have done a lot of impact investing, a lot of climate investing. I call it energy investing. That's the market. But as we were looking for some of that more patient capital in energy, a lot of that also now applies to national security. You've got folks here who are looking around at the world we live in right now. We've had some really horrific things happen, you know, in the last couple of years in our world. And I am not a fear monger, and I don't want to feed on people's fears, but trying to realize, how do I get involved? How do I invest in things that might make my country stronger, that might make my children safer, that are going to help our allies, you know, all of these sorts of things. How do we look holistically at that? And so there have been quite a number of family offices and high net worth individuals that have really stepped forward. And it's been incredible, and put their money there and created an atmosphere now where we can put large dollar amounts into capabilities that we know are going to take potentially even 15 to 20 years, you know, to really mature. But giving companies and entrepreneurs the ability to actually dig into some of that, you know, deep tech is a lot of times the word, looking at materials, looking at all sorts of things. So that's kind of the world that national security investing and interest has kind of developed, which again, you know, having been here for 20 years and watched this really hit a tipping point about 2018. It also coincidentally was around the same time that we realized all the foreign direct investment that was coming here into Silicon Valley.
We paused there. Just kind of, I have another follow-up around the energy national security nexus, because what's so fascinating about the energy and climate category and the national security categories, these are both categories where I feel as if you're, let's say I'm raising a fund or I'm, you know, launching a new VC firm, the thesis section of my website is so easy in both categories. So if energy and climate, you know, I'm in Texas, right? So I could talk about the grid. I could talk about renewables. Anyone who lives anywhere could talk about climate change. And then the same thing is true of the defense category. I could say, look at the stakes, look at Ukraine, look at Eastern Europe, look at how the primes have trouble, look at Taiwan, look at the Indo-Pacific. It's so easy to establish the stakes and just not be full of it. It's just 100% true in both categories. However, the gap between the stakes and the underlying, I think, difficulties of, to your point, timeline, does the model even make sense, seems just so big. So I guess what I'm really asking then, in both categories, because they suffer from the same dynamic, what is the actual case for investing in these categories? Because I've had Mark Andreessen, I've had Catherine Boyle, I've had the founder, I've had everyone of you mentioned on the podcast. I've never asked them this question directly, because I think as I'm thinking about it, I get so wrapped up in the stakes that I don't ask myself, okay, well, there wasn't a VC firm that invested in the internet. The stakes were big, but it actually was just the government. So like, what is the case for VCs, family offices, high net worth people investing here versus an appropriator just saying, you know what, we're going to throw away $500 million on the clean energy future. And if we get there, we need to get there, that will be great because we don't care about losses the same way. I'd love to hear just like how you think about this dynamic.
It's two words: market size. Okay. So energy, $1 trillion market, massive. I mean, energy is everything. You know, a lot of folks inside the military said lack of water, lack of clean water is the greatest indicator of conflict globally. Okay. And here in California, half of California's energy spend is spent pumping water. Yet somehow this energy water nexus thing is new and shiny. It's not. It is the core, right? So if we can't get water to people that need it, You know, we have a lot of people on our coasts near water. That's kind of how our, you know, a lot of our country was established. So energy, market size, huge market, massive market. It's never going out of style. It's never going away. In California, it's embarrassing. The gas station nearest my daughter's school still has $6.99 gasoline, like here, right now. I mean, but people are going to buy it. There's a market. There's a demand, right? So market size and demand. So I guess there's three words. National security, half of our federal budget here in the United States of America is our Defense Department. It is a massive market. The problem is, and the challenge is, and I jokingly call it the military addressable market, the MAM. We're going to use that. We're going to start that. But when you are an investor, sorry, when you're an entrepreneur and you're going to pitch, right, you talk about your total addressable market, your TAM, or your serviceable addressable market, your SAM. What is your market size? Nowhere inside of our government does anyone speak in market terms. Back to this idea of, you know, we're not here to make a dollar. However, if we're trying to get these two worlds to work together and to communicate, the military side, the government side needs to understand that everybody who wakes up in the morning here in the venture community thinks about market size, thinks about making money, thinks about, you know, they're solving problems, but the end result needs to be, but it's not, I don't think it's money just to make money. That's what shows a successful market demand and meeting a demand in the market, right? So when you've got market size, you've got half the US federal budget, and then an energy, you've got, you know, just a $1 trillion energy market, just massive market size. And as much as we, and then I'll take it one step further, you know, bringing in AUKUS, you've got our federal budget. And now we're looking specifically with AUKUS now at the budgets of now Australia and the UK. You go a step further, you're looking at NATO. You've got, you know, however many countries are in NATO, I should know that. But you're looking at allied market size. You're looking at, you know, global market size. We're looking at, as we've, you know, looked at dual use technology space, commercial space was really one that I think changed the conversation. You know, space is inherently global. Space also is an industry where no matter how commercial you are, you have to work with the government. That's just how it is. And that's not a bad thing. And actually, you know, but commercial space getting out there, it's also hardware. What? It's incredibly capital intensive. I mean, it was like the last thing you think, you know, the commercial sector would ever go after, but they did. And it's making a lot of, I mean, it's, the potential to make a great deal of money there. And frankly, we need a whole lot of power, frankly. You know, if you're controlling space, it's a big deal. So you've got all of those things at play, but, you know, market size and demand are two of the biggest, but we're figuring it out. Back to the, you know, the patient capital, and, you know, Andreessen has set up this amazing fund, American Dynamism, which is very focused on that. And, like, thank goodness they have. I mean, that's a stake in the ground if I've ever seen one. To say, hey, we're big, we're going to lead on this. Why? Because it matters.
Yeah. And I'm realizing as you're articulating this, that there's kind of a faulty premise in my question, which is I was basically just treating venture capital investment, et cetera, as just like another means of getting money places. So, okay, we have this option. Congress passes legislation. We have this option, A16Z or like a, you know, big angel investor. But I think the actual, like, as I'm thinking about this, like my personal case for why VC matters from like a policymaking perspective and like a broader defense of the American system is the congressional appropriations process would never have invested or helped set up Anduril. Like the argument is that the venture model, and I think the mindset of someone in Silicon Valley versus someone in DC would look at alternate means, not the status quo, new technological developments. So it was just kind of a flawed premise when I was pushing you on like, what's the case? Because the point is, it's like, not, once again, it's not just money. It's where money's going, and it's how you're even conceptualizing problem sets and challenges the country faces. So I think that's a very like kind of American defense of the system.
It is. And I mean, you know, something though we all talk about in our world as we've been trying to build this world and build, you know, this kind of new face of investing is, you know, three of the top examples, you know, Palantir, Anduril, and SpaceX all have, you know, billionaire founders. So it's not lost on any of us that this is still difficult and still coming along and still being built. But you know what? Somebody had to go first, and they did, and God bless them for it, because, you know, we do have these capabilities now of folks that are pouring a lot of their own money into it. But again, you know, like, we're finding that this really resonates with folks. I'll get asked to go, you know, speak to some families at a dinner, and you know, actually how I kind of first came up with some of my crazy ideas. And they said, you know, my friends, like, we know what you do kind of during the day. We know the world that you communicate with and where your background is. And then we've seen the EX, and is there a way, you know, to kind of start to show people that this is actually, you know, these can be bona fide investments. These are, they're going to take a little bit longer, but this, you know, this stuff does matter. And there potentially is a way for you to invest in these things. Because obviously it's very clear that there's not a lot of transparency around some of these, you know, needs. And so that's another thing we've been trying to work on is signaling from inside the military, inside the government, to the outside, to investors, to entrepreneurs. We run something at Stanford and about 60 other universities called Hacking for Defense. So really building that next generation of national security minded entrepreneurs. So you're not, you don't have to go enlist in the military to serve your country. You don't have to go to Washington DC and work for the government to serve your country. You can start a company that matters and it's solving the problems. And actually that's really what we need. Because we've, you know, we need world-class talent to be tackling world-class challenges. And I guess, you know, this was kind of my cheat system back, you know, in 2015 when I was joining up with Pete Newell and Joe Felter and the BM&T team and Steve Blank. We would have, you know, General Nakasone, the four-star from Cyber Command, come out and want to understand really what would a comprehensive cyber architecture look like. And, you know, go into the Gartner chart, no offense, Gartner, and just saying, you know, who are these top five companies? Let's go meet them. I'm like, what if we actually sat down with the CISO at Visa and talked about, you know, how do you, Visa, large entity worth billions of dollars and in charge of billions of dollars, think about cyber? And maybe that's a better idea than meeting with some startups that aren't, that, you know, you're going to need 27 different startups that are all very dynamic. And what also was going on with our country was we were looking at static problems where you can put a big aircraft carrier and a bunch of metal around something to very dynamic problems such as cyber that are changing constantly. So even if you have, you know, the solution today, it's different in 2 weeks. It's different in 2 months. It's definitely different in 2 years. And so finding teams of people that can actually come in and solve these dynamic problems, and they're going to work closely with you, not just sell you a piece of metal and walk away. And that was a very different, you know, our government didn't even know how to contract, you know, blank as a service, cyber as a service, data as a service. We didn't have a blank as a service contract. That had to be fixed, you know, and it's still being fixed. Also, you know, when we were, you know, having folks like Jonah Nakasone and other folks, Jido, and I mean, you name it, come out and talk to us, I didn't, and this is no offense, and I feel a little, no offense, I apologize, but there are a lot of companies we'll kind of call usual suspects. You know, they're smaller companies, they've been very focused on defense tech, and they do have time, and they take the time to go through what's called SAM.gov, which is our treasure trove of all the, you know, contracts that are out there and available. If you're world-class talent and you're building a world-class company as fast as you can with venture backing, you're not doing that. You're head down, you're nose down, you're doing everything you can to build this and be first to market. So I would go and meet with, you know, with venture capitalists that I'd gotten to know. I did government relations at Stanford for a number of years, and I had some time on my hands sometime. And I was very interested in what is this venture thing? I'm painfully unmotivated by money. Very mission focused, but something's going on here. Like something matters here. And there's a reason that, you know, that top tier investors and that top tier talent end up here and people are willing to move their companies here. And so I would talk to investors and I say, you know, what are you seeing? Would you walk me through your portfolio? Like, what is your thesis? How are you kind of seeing this landscape? And they would, you know, kind of walk me through and I'm like, holy moly, this is amazing. Because, you know, I'd say a third of their companies are like, they'd preface with, okay, you can't tell anyone about this. I work in defense. I'm not telling anybody about anything. I'm a steel trap. But like so many of these companies were still in stealth mode, but they were world-class talent that had come, raised money. Because where does world-class talent go? To investors, to invest in their company that then will become hopefully a unicorn. Mm-hmm. But they're stealth. And I say this jokingly so that my military friends don't get upset with me, but you know who's better at being stealth than our US military? A startup company that wants to be first to market is so much better at it. Just being very quiet. They're building, they're getting feedback, but they're building until they're ready to launch, until mm-hmm. they're truly launch and go as fast as they can. Our government, our military needs to know about those companies before they come out of stealth mode. Could you imagine how much of that 3 to 5 year valley of death we could eliminate if we start to know about these companies and frankly can start to engage with these companies that much sooner, and mm-hmm. have the CTO of the CIA or have, you know, the head of the CDAO, you know, the chief of data and AI office, I believe is the acronym, just come in and have conversations with the investors to talk about, you know, when is this company ready to go? What do you need from us? also to educate the investors on, back to the MAM, the military addressable market size, so that if this investor is saying, you know, not really excited about you going and talking to the government right now, not the military, it's going to slow us down. No, I think, I mean, there has been a mental mind shift, a change in the last few years on that one. I've watched it happen. It's been pretty incredible. But still, I mean, the more that these two worlds can be speaking intelligently to one another, and folks on the inside can be saying, you know, this is what our world looks like right now, and this is what we need. I'll do another quick, very quick example, I guess. So back to Cyber Command, we had their head of external engagement come and talk to our defense investor network, which I'll get to in a second. I know it's the point here. And talk to we have a monthly meeting that's 90 minutes, and had him come and talk about the 31 top of mind challenges that Cyber Command was having. And, you know, a couple of days in advance of the meeting, he sends me this document, and which is 31, you know, very well articulated challenges. So not a requirement sheet, not this is the thing that we think we need to fix it, but rather these are the problems that we're having. And I said, where do you get this document? I've never seen this document. No investor I've ever talked to has seen this document. Where is this? He goes, if you come to the coffee the second Tuesday of the month in Maryland, we'll give you a copy of it. Like, we'll hand you a piece of paper. I'm like, what is happening right now? And this was in 2020, maybe 2021, 2020, I think. So I said, why don't we do this? Why don't, instead of you coming to this group of, you know, 80, 120 investors, you know, that are going to be on the line, if I'm allowed to send this out to them in advance, they can scope, you know, comb through it, and they might actually have, you know, portfolio companies that could help you solve your problem. And I understand what some people out there might be thinking, well, that's a problem. This person's invested in this company. Of course, they're going to be pushing this company. Of course, they're going to be trying to, you know, sell this company to solve a government problem. What I've actually found is through this Defense Investor Network, which we'll get into, is that doesn't happen. We really have people, I jokingly say, but don't, it's not a joke. You know, these investors are putting their Patriot hat on just before they're putting their investor hat on. And so if they have a company, they said, this might solve the problem, but actually I saw another company about 6 months ago, 12 months ago, we couldn't invest in them because they were a direct competitor, or we could invest in them for X, Y, or Z other reason, but you should really check them out. They're fantastic. And frankly, you know, one of their other venture buddies might have invested in them or not. And so just, I use the venture community, frankly, as eyes and ears. They see everything. And they see, you know, those companies that are coming down the pipe.
So quick thing before we get into the actual Defense Investors Network, I'd actually love for you to really explain what the defense tech space is relative to kind of the problem set we're facing as a country right now, because just as part of my episode prep, the Wall Street Journal, speaking of, and I liked, by the way, your articulation of like, this is what you're thinking about all day. Like, this is what you're waking up and focusing on. If you want some like terrible reading, just go read the Wall Street Journal's reporting on the Brits. You know, they can't, this didn't happen, but there was a debate over whether or not they were going to take artillery pieces from museums and actually like put them potentially in the field, because like the supply was that low. They only had 150 tanks. Like, there's all sorts of problems. Like, we don't have the ability to either produce the number or amount of munitions we need, while our shipbuilding capacities also collapse relative to China. These are just like devastating, huge, long-term problems. They're also not exactly the problem set that I think defense VC and tech is focused on. So once you read these articles, it's just kind of hard to talk to I'm sure you meet these people, but I met like an excitable VC who's jumped in the defense space, and he's talking to me about like drones and alternate technology. He read Christian Broz's work, and it's just sort of like, hey, I'm more worried about the fact that we don't have an industrial base in this country. So I'd love you just to kind of like delineate. And also, like, and the last thing too, and I heard you say this on a different podcast, and I really appreciated it. Everything I just said also highlights how this can't just turn into us attacking the defense primes, because these are actually different problems that different people can address. Palmer Luckey is great on the drones front. He's not trying to create an aircraft carrier replacement. He's not trying to build shipbuilding capacity, because that's not something you inherently wouldn't invest in. So I would just love for you, because people are just not good at doing this, but I know you can do it, delineate what are the actual spaces we are talking about relative to the stakes, and then that will lead us helpfully into the Defense Investors Network.
Sure. Great questions. There's a bunch in there. And number one, I this is Palmer's joke, not mine, but you know, they basically had some amazing software that they basically had to wrap in hardware so that our government could figure out how to buy it. And that's not untrue. I wouldn't put it past them to try to, you know, next to try to build the next best aircraft carrier. Who knows? Who knows? It's exciting to watch. I will say this though. You know, it started out with software. Well, that's not true. It's not even true because drones were a big catalyst as well. A lot of drone technologies that we were looking at, it became very clear at some point in time that DJI is a threat, is a problem.
What's DJI?
DJI is a industry leader drone company that China runs, and they got very good at miniaturizing them, making them fun for kids, really making them easy and familiar and great and entertaining. And they're also sending every piece of information back to China, and we know that.
Dual use.
Very dual use against us. The harder part is hard. I mean, you know, the F-35s, I part of the din, and I've been very intentional about this, has been making sure that, you know, Lockheed Martin and Boeing and General Dynamics are part of the conversation. And, you know, I jokingly call the din, you know, Fight Club, and we've had fights, and we had some folks that were very forward leaning on the software side and on some of these, you know, new capabilities. But then, you know, they said, you know, the primes are the problem. They're holding everything up. They're integrators. I mean, they are, you know, there's a big piece of them in a big place in our defense industrial base for them, obviously.
Sorry, and can you define in all of my episodes, everyone talked about primes. I never got anyone to define the primes for the audience, please.
So I'll say this too, and actually, this is so fun. Because our allies, as we're talking about allied forces as well, gosh, so many other people are better at the historical part of this, so I do apologize. Trey does a good job. Josh Marcuse does a great job, really kind of outlining kind of how primes came to be. But it was basically during the Cold War, there were lots of kind of other small companies that basically got consolidated. And so we've got about, 5, 6, 7, you know, large primes at this point. They were the ones that were given large government contracts. A phrase I use a lot of times is innovation at the speed of trust. They were companies that worked with the government so much and earned their trust. And frankly, we've had situations in our history where we had to manufacture, we had to build as fast as we could. And they became, you know, trusted entities, trusted allies that were manufacturing the big things. At this point, I consider them almost basically part of our government. They're definitely part of, like I said, the defense industrial base. But they are the first ones to admit, I mean, and it's you know, that they need to innovate. They need to downside, streamline. They know this, and they're trying to figure out. And so, you know, a dear friend runs, you know, Lockheed Ventures venture arm, or Lockheed Martin's venture arm. And at first, you know, they're investing off balance sheet, and now they have a separate fund that can move more quickly and can figure out, you know, how do you work? How can a startup engage effectively with a prime? Because for a long time, frankly, a lot of startups were warned about working with the prime. Like if you were brought in, so you have a prime who's like the main contractor and a contractor, that kind of the head, and then you've got a sub. So if you're a sub, you're working underneath someone else. You're a smaller company that's working then underneath. So the large prime gets the contract, you're a subcontractor. The challenge was when you're a subcontractor working for a large prime in the past, you got screwed every time. I mean, they basically, you know, if there was an upside to the contract, you know, not like there'd be upside to a startup with equity, but an upside to a contract, the prime took that upside. And so basically they would create a price that you were going to come in and do a certain amount of work for. And that was kind of it. And if the program, you know, blew up in a good way and got very large, you weren't going to make more money. It was just like, you're going to do the work for us. We're going to pay you. Have a nice day. That's changing. And you know, because the primes were realizing no startup worth their salt wanted to come work with them, because basically you'd get hosed. You know, you wouldn't be involved in any of that upside. That's something that we're also working on. But you know, they are a big piece of this.
And quick thing, this is also a brilliant example of the limits of the traditional like Silicon Valley playbook. And I'm sure the source of a lot of the fights you're describing, in the sense that, you know, if it's Uber in 2009, like Travis Kalanick isn't talking about like working with the taxi industry. The entire case for Uber is, look at this incumbent legacy industry that doesn't work. So like the defense ecosystem by its very nature, you sometimes you're competing with them, other times their existence is your justification, but other times you're in this weird subcontractor dynamic. So you're really illustrating like how complicated this gets.
It is very complicated. And the Uber, I was living in DC and working for New York when Uber was, happening. And you actually had a guest on your podcast, Bradley Tusk, and I actually worked with him in Schumer's office a number of years ago. So seeing how, but I think both in, I watched his podcast and in his process, and the reason he was on there, kind of came back to, and the same reason I do too. It's like these are very complicated problems to solve, and we need people who are willing to really jump in the middle of them. And a lot of us had been on the inside and are now on the outside, but we care so much. And I hate to say, I don't mean to sound like Pollyanna, but like it really comes down to that, like mission focus, like this stuff matters. And being able to translate between these two worlds. I mean, I'm basically a glorified translator. That's what I, I'm not afraid to go in. And, the DIN is a great, platform for that. It's like, I'll bring in a two-star program manager or a PO or whomever, and we'll have this conversation. The whole time I'm kind of like, in the chat saying what that acronym means, or this is the reality of it. Or then an investor will talk about their returns or valuation. What does that mean? Just the word acquisition. The word acquisition out here in venture land means you're buying a company. The word acquisition in government land, right, means you're just trying to use it. I mean, that we need to remedy that. I mean, that's so basic. But just this translation is very difficult. And so the more though that we can have people on the outside understanding what people on the inside need, and then frankly have the people on the inside creating new mechanisms, and I'll get to DIU in a second because I love them, in order to rapidly, we call it mission acceleration, to really rapidly contract and to rapidly get these capabilities into the hands of the warfighter, into the hands of whoever needs them, frankly, but then have an ongoing relationship. Right? DIU has actually went in. It gets more complicated. And so other
And that's the
transactions,
Defense Innovation Unit, right?
Defense Innovation Unit, great. They were set up, I guess, about 8 years ago down here at Moffett Field. I just point there because that's where Moffett Field is here in Mountain View, California, as really to be like the front door so that startups and investors could come and learn what are some of the real-time challenges. How do we talk to a human being about some of this stuff, right? And this was, they set up and they put up a pathways program. They put program managers in place, and it's been pretty remarkable. They'll put with a CSO, and I'm going to get this wrong. It's not commercial service opportunity, but it's something like that. It's their rapid contracting capability, and they were getting people on contract in 60 days. Before, it used to take a year, if not more, if ever, because sometimes, startups or investors would be like, "We don't have time for this." It literally came down to, "We don't have time for this." So DIU has been, I think, very successful. They've had a couple of iterations. They have a new director, Doug Beck, who's doing, came from Apple. I mean, they're not afraid to kind of bring in folks who he also had a very prestigious 25-year military career. So, but somebody who's had training on both sides. Mike Brown was his predecessor and was incredible. Again, private sector experience came in and really tried to help translate these sorts of things. And so the more that we can get folks learning both languages, comfortable communicating both languages. A couple people I've mentioned already though had been on the inside, came out to the outside, and we're sitting out here trying like hell. Like as fast as we can. And so, getting the investors, I think, educated. They know a whole lot about their world. They know how to diligence companies. They know all of that. Getting them educated about the government world, but frankly, also getting the government world to be educated about the venture world. About the, and then we'll go one step further, private equity. A lot of these things are very capital intensive and farther along. I will say this too, just a total plug, but there's a group called Shift. He's amazing. Mike Slag
Mike
runs.
was on the podcast last week, so there's a
Love
theme
him.
here.
Love, love, love. He runs the Defense Ventures Forum and the Defense Ventures Fellows Program. We're actually pulling folks from inside of government, outside, right, to put them working at venture capital firms, working at portfolio companies. What better way, like, to really understand how this goes down than to sit in there and watch it and watch the really, really great days and the really sucky days when you think the company's going to go under, or you're trying to figure out if you're going to make this investment. And at the end of the day, half the time it's your gut, right? And a lot of times situations that we put our war fighters in and our military in, a lot of times there's gut decisions made. And so it's not all that different, but different things are at stake, and it's, no one's shooting at these guys over here.
So I think now's the opportunity to just get the explicit articulation of what the DIN actually is, and then in that part.
So the Defense Investor Network, and I literally never talk about this. We've literally treated it like Fight Club. So this is a bit of a coming out party for us a bit, but that's been intentional. It's really it's a network. It's a family. There are no dues. No one pays for it. The government does not pay for it. It is really a coming together of originally U.S. investors, and really the goal behind it was that they're clean, no foreign direct investment. So we know that, and that's not every country is a problem. We have 37 countries of special concern that we call them at the government level, and then there's the big four. And so we have to make sure that your fund is clean, but we come together and we've got folks from assistant secretaries to assistant secretary of investment over at Treasury for Investment Security to talk about CFIUS, talk about CFIUS regulations. That's kind of how this whole thing started back in 2019. CFIUS, again, Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., Foreign Direct Investment, was noticing that there was a whole lot coming into this valley. We'd say very, very safely $22 billion from 2010 to 2018. And I guarantee you that that's probably 20% of it, if not even less. We call it adversarial capital. I call it nefarious. I think it's funnier. But adversarial capital kind of coming into the valley here, buying, you know, putting large investments into companies, buying IP, stealing IP, stealing, you name it. It was happening. It's still happening. I'll go a step further. Even, you know, the semiconductor portfolio at our beloved Incutel, which I love, has a lot of Chinese investment in it. That's a problem. People kind of don't believe me when I say that, but that's the truth. And so looking at CFIUS, but then saying, okay, we're going to really beef up CFIUS. We need to do more. And I talked to some of my friends who are working on it, who are inside of OSD, Office of Secretary of Defense. The DASD for Industrial Policy was there looking at the whole industrial base. And I said, if you put a startup company or even a later stage startup company into CFIUS review, and it's basically hands are tied for maybe 9 months during the CFIUS review, that kills companies. So can we please, if we're going to have this conversation, can we please come and talk to the investors, find out what the actual benefits are, what are the unintended consequences? And then frankly, let's just go back and think, do we need to beef it up? Which we do in certain ways, but what if we just went left of it? What if we just avoided it? What if we actually solved the actual problem, not put a bandaid on it, but actually go back and hold some of these people's feet to the fire a little bit about taking adversarial capital and putting it into their funds or companies taking money from, you know, from funds that are compromised. I don't like to put the onus on the companies because I've been a startup co-founder and it's hard. And to put the onus on the company is difficult, but let's put the onus on the investors and make sure that they're clean and make sure that they know who their LPs are and frankly, what the intentions of their LPs are. And no more can we just be like, you know, ignorance is bliss. I don't have to think about it. I'm going to take my returns and I'm going to go home and sit on my yacht or fly my plane. That's not okay anymore. We need to put some of the onus on those investors that, you know, if you're a successful venture capitalist, you're making good money. And so let's make sure that you're making it, not to the detriment of our country. I mean, when we first did the DIN, it was kind of a joke, but I said, you know, we're not asking you to do good for your country. We're just asking you not to do bad for your country. That is such a low bar. And so I don't feel bad, you know, bullying is the wrong word, but being a little bit in your face about it, like this stuff matters. And if we can, you know, shut off the fire hose to the nefarious, to the adversarial capital in the start, we still have some things we need to fix. We still have some companies that are highly compromised and that are mission critical. So it's kind of mission relevant, but those companies that really are mission critical, we need to make sure that we've cleaned them up. And so, you know, back to some family offices, high net worths, more of that patient capital. We've had some that have raised their hand and said, I'm willing to go in and help you clean up some of these companies. That's amazing. And, you know, a couple have even said, I said, okay, top three priorities, if you're going to help us do this, where on this top three list is making you more money right away or making you more money kind of in a venture time frame? And they said, number seven. And like, that also is incredible. And this isn't, you know, Republicans or Democrats, it's everybody. This is coming from all states. It's been really incredible to watch. And so again, this is, you know, we're building this now, but the idea of building, you know, out a network of those families that are interested in national security. And again, this doesn't have to be weapon systems, but you know, there might be a flavor of some of that to some of this. But at the same time, there's a lot that you can be investing in. I mean, you know, soldier wearables, things to make sure our soldiers are safe and are performing at a high level. Definitely drones. We're looking at eVTOLs, electric vertical takeoff and lift, flying taxis. That's obviously potentially a commercial market. You name it. I mean, you know, anything around, you know, AI ethics, that, you know, all of these things fit into these buckets. And so, you know, I know the White House has their list. The Pentagon has their list of kind of national security imperatives or national security, you know, relevant technologies. Okay. I think one of them has 14 of them or 15. One bullet is energy. So if they're a little vague. They're a little odd, but it's everything. You know, it really is everything at this point. You know, back to elemental quickly, EEX. One thing we were looking at is food security. You know, at any given point in time, you know, Hawaii has about 2.5 days worth of food on island, and that's without a military insurgency. So like just food security, you know, clean water, again, you know, renewable energy that doesn't rely on foreign oil. I mean, all these sorts of things. So all those fit into the national security bucket. We're looking at forward operating bases, cleaning up power there, using hydrogen, all sorts of things are on the table. But it really isn't just aircraft carriers, F-35s, you know, rockets, you know, that kind of thing, or in our weapon system. It really runs the gamut. So it's just been amazing. So the DIN, like I said, comes together. We've got, you know, investors, I think we're about 300 members at this point, US investors, but we've got, you know, there's a certain percentage that are very, very savvy. You know, you've got folks in there that know exactly what they're doing, and they've been working in government. They might have been part of the intelligence community, but they are so good, and they know exactly which policies need to be changed. And we can get into ITAR either now or another time. What sorts of things need to be changed? We need to be modified. And then you've got some folks who know enough to be dangerous. And then you've got folks that really know nothing. And if we can use these sessions as a way to educate people and to get them comfortable with the concept, it really isn't scary. It's what I think is scary is not doing anything about this. That's far scarier than, you know, than getting in and starting to do some of these investments. So, I mean, that the AUKUS DIN then kind of came about. We launched an Australia DIN about a year and a half ago. Australia, obviously, when you're talking about supply chain, you're talking about metals, materials, rare earths, that sort of thing. Huge, massive for our supply chain and the security of our supply chain. We started the UK DIN about, it was March of this year. And it really wasn't, we weren't doing this to pick the AUKUS countries. It just, that's kind of where we've seen a lot of pull for this sort of thing, kind of where the investment communities are robust. And they were saying, how do we all start talking? It was actually an investor, Martin Dersma from Main Sequence Ventures in Australia, super lovely. He's the venture arm of basically their national labs, it's called CSIRO. And he's like, how do we start talking to the US investors? How do we start, you know, if we're investing in these four or five or six things, they've got a great quantum, you know, a lot of great quantum stuff coming out of there. How do we start engaging with US investors? They're, you know, the US investor network and the US investor community is just orders of magnitude larger, as is our defense industry. So if we can get our allies working on our problems, how great is that? And if they've got world-class talent that needs some of our investment, how great is that? So like, you know, it really is kind of coming together. And then as we have been talking to, you know, there are a number of great initiatives from DIU to OSC, the Office of Strategic Capital, that's just been set up at the OSD level inside the Pentagon. Amazing crew over there, you know, trying to figure out again how to bridge these two worlds. But as we're talking to them, they're reporting straight to Austin, straight to our Secretary of Defense. And then he's having conversations with allied, you know, ministers of defense and secretaries of defense. And somehow, you know, this concept, you know, caught people's ear and said, you know, rather than reinventing the wheel, why don't we engage and leverage, you know, this group that's been going on for almost 5 years. And, you know, we're kind of a family. We talk very openly about things. Like I said, we've legit had fights, meetings, but it's because there've been misunderstandings. Typically fights like that are because there's a misunderstanding about the role of the primes. There's a misunderstanding about, you know, about why venture will invest in certain founders and not others potentially, you know, and just kind of how people think and how people are doing. But just like anything else in life, you know, everyone has their own opinion and their own thesis, and it changes all the time. And so making sure that it's not just a conference once a year, and there are some really meaningful conferences, but this needs to be a regular, you know, cadence conversation kind of thing, so that people are really getting the whole picture.
I like what you're saying, just because, you know, it's kind of easy just to say, oh, like, we need to get everyone in the room, and these ecosystems are so spread out and, you know, diffuse. But when you do that, inevitably, part of the reason why things are separate is that actually serves as kind of a firewall against conflict, and those different things. So I think it's good that you could like acknowledge that's a real, not just a cost of doing business, but it shows you're actually doing what you need to do. So I just want to close on this, and we'll have to do this again next year, because there's a million different other, I don't want to say rabbit holes, because that makes it seem like insignificant. There are a million other high stakes areas we need to go into, but I just want to close with this. Like, I appreciated in a previous conversation you describing just like your mission focused feeling around, you know, being an appropriator in Senator Schumer's office in the wake of 9/11. And then like getting involved in national security and then going to SV and kind of like being just in this space. I think there are a lot of people, especially young people, who are kind of feeling, and this is why a lot of people get it, like the episodes that I'm doing in this series are the ones that actually get the most, not just like positive feedback, but the most like positive reach out, as in, oh, I would like to do this. Oh, this is interesting. Oh, it's cool to see people are thinking about these things. So I'd love you just kind of like close with like some encouragement for folks who, you know, in the face of a bunch of big problems, are kind of looking for something to do and contribute at all kind of different levels.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Thank you. First of all, again, thank you for this platform. Like, thank you for having these conversations and you know, letting us talk about these things that we think about. I mentioned earlier Hacking for Defense. You know, it's a graduate level program that started at Stanford. It's world class talent, and it's, you know, it's at about 70 universities now. It's absolutely incredible. It's at Georgetown. It's at MIT. It's really bringing. I understand the feeling of like, how do I get in and help, and how do I use my skill set? You know, rather than, you want to volunteer. I mean, that's great and all, but like, how do I actually potentially dedicate my life? But you can do well by doing good. You know, you can really do well by doing good. And so, you know, but part of it's been on the onus of our government, our military, to create those sorts of openings. But, you know, Hacking for Defense, it's actually run by something called the Common Mission Project, a nonprofit, CMP. You can find it all over LinkedIn. And so, you know, find that. Alex Gala runs it. He's tremendous. And, you know, we need mentors for these student teams. We need, you know, so if you know how to build startups, they come with a problem statement. We have problem owners from inside the government. So these aren't hypothetical problems they're working on. And I'd say one, maybe two teams each class from all around the country. And actually we've got, I think, four universities in the UK, a couple in Australia. We're expanding. We're actually looking at the Nordic region right now. You know, a couple of those teams actually then come out or graduate and want to keep working on this. And so we'll find them some early stage, you know, money to do that. And they build real things, and they're solving real time problems and getting things in the hands of the warfighters as quickly as possible. That's amazing. So if anybody is in the investment community or family office and just wants to understand more about it, about, you know, how we're sourcing deals or how we're looking at the world, I'm more than happy to talk. I talk to everybody. I talk all the time. Hence why I didn't have a voice last Friday. But I get so excited about this and have so much energy about it. And I'm going to be doing this till I'm 80. So sorry for all of you. But there are so many ways to get involved in whatever your comfort level is, whatever your resources are, whatever, you know, experience you have. But back to, you know, mentoring some of these companies. To be honest, earlier today, I had a conversation with part of our team that is building out. We're doing a contract with ARPA-H. So NIH is now starting an innovation arm. And, you know, people from the biotech space, from the biomedical space, that can serve as mentors and to help them figure out what should a fellows program look like. And they're coming to the outside. They're coming out to the, you know, the private sector saying, okay, you know, these are four programs that have seen wildly successful. How do we use your lessons learned? They're actually, you know, talking to folks. And I will say one thing that's been a frustration in the past is once you've got a contract that's open, the program managers aren't allowed to talk to the people applying for it. Where here in Silicon Valley, you talk to the team constantly. That's all you do. And everyone says, you know, what are you investing in? Team, people, people, people. And so, you know, until these two worlds can constantly be communicating person to person, and frankly, back, I'll leave you with this, you know, my favorite, you know, innovation is the speed of trust, and trust is built on personal relationships. And in the past, our military and our government, you're almost not allowed to have those personal relationships. We have to have those personal relationships, and we have to move faster. We have to innovate at the speed of trust, and we have to innovate faster than our adversaries.
That is an excellent place. Leave it. Heather, thank you for joining me on The Realignment. We will definitely do this again next year.
Thank you, Marshall. Happy holidays. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like this sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.